thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums. This is Digital Campus number 37 for the 2nd of February 2009, Material Culture. I'm Dan Cohen. And it's time for another Digital Campus podcast from the Center for History and New Media. We have with us today a special guest from the Center for History and New Media, our Director of Public Projects, Sharon Leon. Hey, Sharon.
Hi, Dan. Glad to be with you today.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast. And Sharon can be found in many places on a lot of our projects at the center. If you click on our Division of Public Projects, which is the tab on collections and exhibits in the middle of the homepage at chnm.gmu.edu. And let's see, we can also find you on Twitter, which we'll get to in a minute, Mills, at SLEONCHNM. So welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on. We should have had you on before.
Thank you.
And since we're going to be talking about museums later in the featured part of the program, feature story, it'll be good to have you here, but also good to have you here for the news roundup, which we'll start in just a second after we talk to our other two podcasters, Mills Kelly, of course. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Sharon. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Mills. Of course, at edwire.org, great blog on education and technology, and Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hey, Tom.
Hello, all.
How are
Hi,
you
Tom.
Doing? Great. So welcome, everyone. We're going to kick right in. Of course, we should have mentioned, Tom, you're also on Twitter at foundhistory, which we discussed last time. I'm at Dan Cohen. And Mills, you showed up on Twitter in the last 2 weeks at Mills Kelly. Everyone on the listening to the podcast should follow Mills Kelly on Twitter, which he's not really... Mills, would you like an explanation?
Yes, I would like an explanation because I sure didn't sign up, and I think actually it's under Ed Wired. Somebody.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. Ed Wired.
Yeah, somebody, and I suspect possibly one other member of the podcast who shall remain nameless seems to have signed me up on Twitter without actually pre-approving that. So, yes, I do exist on Twitter, although I have to say I'm still not using it.
It wasn't me. I have plausible deniability. I think it's someone in our audience. I really do.
Yeah, it wasn't me.
Who's reserved your name.
Let's just say that some of the graduate students at CHNM have been pointing fingers vaguely in one direction, but...
Right. Well, I think you should all follow Mills Kelly. Let's see, Mills. You at Ed Wired.
Ed Wired, yeah.
Let's see. Yeah, you've got... 29 followers already on Twitter, Mills, even though you don't exist there yet.
And what's the difference between a follower and a stalker?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is our resident Twitter expert, Twitter skeptic, excuse me, joining us on the podcast, Mills Kelly, at Ed Wired on Twitter. Also want to say that Digital Campus is now on Twitter, and we want to thank the 100 people who signed up to follow us online so quickly, and also for... all their replies and conversation over the last 2 weeks about episode 36 on Twittering. If you are on Twitter, do follow us at Digital Campus. It's also where we're taking requests for feature stories and asking for news items that we discuss here at the beginning of the program. And also using it right now live so that people can... I've tweeted what we're discussing on the podcast, and people are getting back to me by replying to Digital Campus. So if we see a good comment in Twitter from our followers, we'll read it on air. So let's dive right in. Well, I guess, you know, being here in Washington, D.C., we haven't discussed politics as much as we probably should. And I guess the biggest thing that's going on right now downtown on Capitol Hill is the stimulus package. And I think a lot of our listeners are at institutions that are kind of trying to get a chunk of this money for digital projects. So Mills, Sharon, Tom, what have you heard, and what's going on in this bill that you think might be of interest to our listeners?
Well, I haven't taken too close a look at the line items in the budget. I am working on a grant proposal this week, and so the federal budget is a little bit of heavy reading for me right now. But I do understand that there is money for broadband infrastructure. I think that's important, and that seems like if it passes, will be a good thing. It seems like we are, you know, surprisingly low on the table of the United States. That is surprisingly low on the table of broadband penetration among countries in the developed world. And I think just getting even just that infrastructure up and getting more people connected to the web with what I think any of us would say is even a minimally suitable connection is like important to our entire field. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think in the original budget there was something like $2 billion for broadband. $6 billion for broadband. I'm not sure what actually came out in the final many hundreds of pages, but certainly billions for high-speed connections. Tom, as you note, I think we're something like 25th in the world here in the U.S. in terms of broadband connections. And so all the content we produce here at the center is, particularly the rich content. We're doing more and more video and multimedia that requires a fast connection that's, difficult to watch over a slower connection. How about foundations and funders like the NEH? Sharon, you were mentioning earlier before we got on the podcast that there might be some additional money at NEA and NEH.
Well, yes, I was watching the news last night, and I noticed that one of the things that seems to be most quickly on the chopping block to get Republicans on board with the stimulus is the $50 million for NEA. And that made me wonder why there was not at least a gesture of equivalent investment in the NEH. I think it's unlikely that either of these are ever actually going to come to pass. I think they may go the way of sodding the lawn on the mall. but it would be, it seems to me that it's something worth considering why the NEA would get a significant investment like that and the NEH wouldn't, given the other concerns amongst the administration about digital capabilities and new media and the directions that the NEH is going with the Office of Digital Humanities.
Yeah, it is. That is surprising. I mean, it looked during the transition like they were going to put, more attention to culture, let's say, like culture in general, where they had a person on their transition team. I can't remember who they named, but someone on their transition team who was dedicated to looking at NARA and NEH and NEA and filling positions at those institutions and getting more resources for them. Surprising that's not been maintained through this legislative fight.
Right. Yeah, but I think one of the big problems is the political problems, because now we're talking about politics rather than reality, is that the so much of the argument about the stimulus package has been the degree to which any program will or will not create jobs. And it's a little harder to make the argument that funding for the NEA or the NEH is going to be a job creation program.
You know, the Library of Congress did try to I think grab a piece of this by having a meeting to show that they're ready to digitize, a significant section of their holdings. They had a kind of a press conference with the Internet Archive, who they've partnered with, that has a scanning center right there at the Library of Congress on Capitol Hill. Not sure if that went anywhere. We'll talk about the Smithsonian in a few minutes, but I'm assuming they wouldn't mind getting into this in terms of scanning projects, which, as I was blogging, are, in a sense, they're shovel ready, as the sort of phrase of the day here in Washington is called. So projects that are ready to go right away. But, maybe that's not something that's sort of obviously related to job creation, although, as we all know, being here in Washington, there's a lot of stuff in an $825 billion bill that, isn't directly related to job creation. So it's a tricky political calculus. It does seem like the arts and humanities, you know, people in these institutions are always a step behind in terms of asking for this money. They need to be out in front of it a lot sooner. Well, over at whitehouse.gov, and a kind of related story, I mean, Obama's team is very technically adept, and I think we've, you know, discussed pieces of that before here on the podcast. They obviously did incredible social networking work and website work on change.gov, which has now become whitehouse.gov. And we're always interested in open access and the open access movement here on the podcast. And I thought it was interesting that over the last week they added a Creative Commons license to user contributions on the site. You know, in the United States, all government documents are obviously public domain. They're paid for by tax dollars, but it's never been clear what happens to outside contributions. And it looks like now those will be, you know, able to be reused as long as they're attributed to their original speakers or contributors on the site. Is this a big moment for Creative Commons where maybe it you know, goes a little bit more mainstream than it's been?
I think it's in some ways, I think, you know, the Obama administration brings a new attention to this, but I think in some ways it's a continuation of a trend that started even a couple of years ago, at least within the agencies we deal with, where they, you know, NEH and IMLS started requiring that, you know, software developed or code developed for their projects be open source. That became at least a near requirement of the funding that they were doling out. They were really encouraging using open source and developing open source. And so, you know, I think these open licenses are starting to take hold. I hope that with the Obama administration, it's going to get a new focus. I hope that this whitehouse.gov development is part of that. You know, but I mean, and even in terms of the economics of this, I was having a conversation yesterday with my only other Ubuntu friend at CH&M, Jim Safley. And we were talking about how if you want to, you know, part of what Obama wants to do is spend money to stimulate the economy, but he's also made gestures towards fiscal responsibility in the budget and saving money where he can and cutting programs and costs where he can within the budget. And I think one place where you could cut an awful, awful lot of cost is in the Windows and Microsoft Office licenses that are paid for every single computer that is owned by the federal government. I mean, imagine if all of those machines that are sitting on all of those agency desks all over the country were replaced with Ubuntu and OpenOffice, and you weren't, let's say, every 3 years paying $500 for a new Windows license and $500 for a new Office license. I mean, $1,000 on every computer in the federal government every 3 years. If they move to something like that, I think that would be a huge benefit to the open source movement, but also to the federal budget. And we've seen other countries do things like that. Germany has done it. Brazil has done it. Spain has done it. And so I'm hoping that this signals a similar shift in the Obama administration.
It's a great point. I mean, I guess it's a lot like making the buildings green, the government buildings green. You can really cut down on costs by software costs. Well, I guess another story related to software costs, as we continue our depression era podcasting series here at Digital Campus. You know, we've talked a lot about universities saving money by moving to Google and Google Apps and Gmail, which a lot of students are already coming in with. And we've said, well, one of the limiting factors has been, you know, for the past year that there isn't an offline version of Gmail. That seems to have changed over the last week. I know, Tom, you're a Gmail addict. And Sharon, are you a Gmail person as well?
I am, indeed.
As am I.
Oh, wow, three of you.
Yeah, I mean, I use my Mason email as my main email, and then Gmail is my secondary email.
Huh. So have any of you downloaded Google Gears for Gmail, which is the technology that now allows you to get on a plane and type out emails, and then it'll send it when you get back off the plane?
Yeah, I did yesterday afternoon when I first saw it. It first appeared in my Gmail Labs menu. I downloaded all 60,000 emails that I have saved in Gmail. It took about I was on a fast connection at school, but it took about, 20 minutes, 30 minutes to download everything, and now it's all available offline. I've had one little problem, which is that when I've got Google Gears running in Firefox and running Gmail, if I log out and try to log in with a different Gmail account, I have a couple different things for different things. It kind of freaks out and won't deal with it. So I can't run multiple Gmail accounts now on my machine unless I deactivate Google Gears. So that's one little bug that I've found. But if you're, for my primary email account with where I've got all my email saved, and it seems to work great and works offline and is a huge help for me, who I live in Gmail. So this is a big thing.
Sharon, is this going to make you want to use Gmail more, or does it make it more of a kind of real possibility for, let's say, a university wants to switch over their entire system, let's say, move all their staff and administrative staff over?
I think it does. I mean, I'm resistant to download my email off of Gmail just because I'm used to having it in one central sort of cloud location. But I think as the semester goes on and I face, unfortunately, many, many, many weekends away on travel, that it's going to be a more appealing option. And I imagine having that option now will increase the adoption percentage across the country for institutions that don't really want to pay to maintain a web system a webmail system. It's just too much trouble.
Mills, how about you? Is this something that you think will change your relationship to it, or the relationship?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for me, it's the question of being able to keep it, like Sharon said, being able to keep it linked so that wherever I am, I can get at it. But I downloaded it last night and played around with it. Since it's my secondary email, I didn't have 60,000 to download. It was more like several hundred. And I'm pretty ruthless about deleting emails from that account. And it went about 3 seconds. And so far, it seems to work fine.
Okay. Well, let's keep an eye on this. It seems like this is just the first version. I do like that they have this flaky connection mode, which I think is a pretty funny name for it, but makes a lot of sense with the way Wi-Fi often works, where you kind of have it a little bit sometimes, and it goes on and off. We've all been in that situation. It seems to me that if people are really going to move to web apps and to these little netbooks that we discussed in the year-end review in December, they're going to need flaky connection aware software, or software that kind of understands that you might have an internet connection for a little bit, but you might lose it and you don't want to lose your work. Seems like a pretty critical component in terms of reliability. Well, finally, in the news roundup, one of our favorite hobby horses is Wikipedia and the question of reliability. And so we were all kind of fascinated by Jimmy Wales, the chief Wikipedian's kind of floating a proposal for a new moderation policy that seems to be gaining some traction, whereby new users and anonymous users might not get the privilege to have their edits to Wikipedia articles appear immediately. Mills, you've talked a lot about Wikipedia on the podcast. Do you think this is a good change, or does it really change the whole model of Wikipedia, where it's supposed to be a frictionless environment where anyone can quickly go in and edit? Does this make sense to you as a kind of way to stop vandalism on articles, or to kind of slow down the propagation of incorrect information? I guess it came up when a couple of articles showed, biographies showed the person as being deceased when they weren't, I think.
Yeah, so I can't remember what actually
precipitated it. Yeah.
Happened.
Was that Sinbad, the rumor that was going around that Sinbad died?
That was a while ago. That was a while ago.
I mean, I guess they've had
Sinbad
several.
Didn't cause this crisis in Wikipedia.
Nor did The Last American Pirate. But it's just been an ongoing issue for them. But I think it's a mistake, personally. And the reason I think it's a mistake is that I think that the incredible success of Wikipedia has been built on this frictionless environment. The idea that really the crowd is sourcing the encyclopedia kind of thing that it is. And there are obvious downsides that we've talked about a lot on the podcast, but I think the upside is keeping the environment as open as possible. I mean, people, if they don't know how Wikipedia is created and edited, they should, and they have to pay a little bit of attention. But we spend a lot of time trying to teach our students to pay attention to that. But
I think it's the success of the enterprise is based on its openness. And so to start closing it off in that way, even minimally, I think is a big mistake.
Well, we're going to discuss crowdsourcing and frictionless environments with museums in just a minute in the feature story. So maybe we'll turn to that right now. And as our featured story today, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, we did want to talk about museums and how they are going to migrate or evolve into the digital age. And I was at a conference on Smithsonian 2.0, what the Smithsonian's going to do in the digital realm. They've taken some sort of baby steps in that direction, but they're kind of looking for an overall vision for where this giant museum complex, the largest in the world, is going to go. And so we wanted to talk a little bit about that, some of the negatives of museums digitizing and moving their stuff online, some of the positives as well. And I thought a good place to start on this is just with a kind of interaction that happened between Chris Anderson, who is the very hip editor of Wired magazine, and some curators over lunch. And the gist of it was this: there was a discussion of a really terrific site from the Smithsonian's Postal Museum, and the site is on the history of U.S. stamps and their design and production. It's available at arago.si.edu. That's arago.si.edu. Really terrific, well-designed site. You can search through their collection. And as part of this, again, this is part of their experimentation in the world of Web 2.0, which a lot of museums are now doing. They have actually tried to kind of crowdsource information about these stamps. And earlier in the day, the people who are in charge of Arago kind of talked about their policy of how they digitized these stamps and put them online, and then how they tried to have the people who come visit contribute to knowledge about the stamps, because obviously there's a lot of philatelists out there in the U.S. and in the world who know quite a bit about these things. And they thought, well, maybe these people can help out with adding some metadata and adding some information about the stamps. So they opened up this site, but they immediately instituted a policy, which was that you had to be a published scholar on the history of stamps to get a login to add information. So they weren't taking that full Wikipedia mode that we just discussed of kind of allowing anyone to come in and edit the information or add tags to these stamps. And Chris Anderson over lunch really took them to task for it. He said, look, maybe you're losing out on some of this information. That in a Web 2.0 world, museums have to just kind of get their stuff out there. Yes, you'll have a lot of people come in and add junky comments, but you'll also find people who are really enthusiastic amateurs who'll be able to add information to your collections, and that the Web 2.0 world of the future for museums is one in which they digitize their collections, kind of get it out there, and the crowd kind of comes in, uses it, remixes it, adds information, and that curators and administrators of museums are just going to have to get used to this idea that they are kind of ceding control to that vast world out there on the web. So maybe if we can pick up there from the Wikipedia conversation we just had. Sharon, what is your thought on this idea of the kind of vetted contributors that arago.si.edu, that model, which felt more comfortable to these curators versus the kind of wide open model? One curator kind of stood up and asked of Chris Anderson, well, doesn't this idea of giving it to the crowd belittle or anti-intellectualize the objects? These are precious objects, and aren't we losing something by kind of digitizing them, putting them online, and kind of releasing them in this very open fashion? Where do you stand on this tension between the authentic museum object and the digitized version online?
Well, I think that the question of the authentic object and the digitized version is a separate question than that of whether or not we let the public at large comment on things and contribute to the conversation. I know curators are really quite disturbed about this idea of people who are not credentialed experts having a say in what the metadata is, or what the sort of creation of context around an object is. Of the curators I've spoken to, if the question is framed in as a problem that can be solved by design, by making a clear distinction in the display between the enthusiast's contribution and the credentialed scholar's contribution, then they seem to calm down about it quite a good deal. And so I think if there's a way to distinguish between Community 1 and Community 2, that eases some of those fears. I think the question of authenticity, the real thing versus the digital thing, is also sort of a false problem. I think we find that all of our research suggests that individuals who interact with collections online are more likely to then eventually want to come see the thing in person, and that curators and museum directors have to accept the fact that digital presence is going to drive traffic to their physical collections.
Did somebody actually say anti-intellectualize the object?
That's the exact phrase. Yes.
Oh my God. If that statement, that turn of phrase doesn't sum up the problem here, I don't know what does. I mean, the idea that an object has to be intellectualized is, I mean, okay, I don't know this person, and so I probably shouldn't criticize them too much, but that's just nuts. I mean, the idea that the public can't know as much about an object as some expert is, to me, just crazy. Especially, okay, I happen to know a lot about stamps because I come from a stamp collecting family, and I got to tell you, there are a lot of stamp collectors out there that know way more about individual stamps than any intellectual, I guess we'll call them, some credentialed expert might know. We see this in history all the time. I mean, the incredible detailed knowledge about the American Civil War that enthusiasts have, or baseball cards, or whatever you want to pick, to say that blocking the public is necessary so that we can keep the objects intellectualized in some way, this is just crazy.
Well, I think that it came up when, I think it was a kind of leftover from the presentation by George Oates, who kind of created the Flickr Commons, was just laid off by Flickr, actually, and Yahoo. And the night before this talk by Chris Anderson, she was showing some of the tags on Flickr Commons, which, as I'm sure our audience knows, is a place where museums can come and post digital images of their holdings, and then the very vast 100 million users of Flickr can kind of come and tag them. And she was showing a kind of tag cloud or list of keywords that people had assigned. And, you know, some of them are pretty, you know, jokey or tongue-in-cheek, like pictures of guys with mustaches. That was one of them that there was a lot of discussion about. And so these curators were looking at tags like that versus what they considered to be helpful keywords, and said, well, you know, doesn't this detract from the object? I think that was the gist of that comment, that yes, maybe it helped people find photos of people with mustaches, but, did it really help with historical research or with a true appreciation of the object that the curator would try to get across in, let's say, the copy on the wall next to the object in the physical museum?
I guess I forgot how reverent I'm supposed to be when I go to a museum. I guess, you know, silly me, I thought I was there to learn something, to be entertained, to enjoy myself, to commune with various objects. I forgot that it was a house of worship.
Well, I think the main point here, I think Sharon has it exactly right. Like, why can't it be both? I mean, why can't we have, you know, pictures of guys with mustaches and something more intellectualized? And I think there are some simple ways, as Sharon suggests, with design to do that. I think there can be multiple conversations going on about these objects. All of these objects, I think if the historiography and the scholarship of the last 30 years of public history has taught us anything, is that these objects and the stories that surround them have multiple meanings to multiple people. Different people will make of them what they will, whether the curators try to lock down that interpretation or not. And so if we can come up with ways to facilitate that discussion, to guide that discussion, to for curators to enter the discussion that's already happening amongst the public about these objects and the narratives that surround them, I don't really see a problem here. And my sense is, in some respects, this is a generational problem. We already do see, even at an institution as heterogeneous and as in some ways tradition bound as the Smithsonian, we already see things cropping up. I mean, we see individual public programming staff and individual curatorial staff taking initiative, getting online with Twitter, doing different things. It's not coordinated, and I think that was in many ways the part of the role of this, the aim of this Smithsonian 2.0 conference. But it's already happening, and I think it may have lagged behind these developments in other places in some respects, but I do think it's happening, and I think we're going to see these tensions resolved in the next couple of years.
I mean, I suppose that the real tension is, or what's really happening is, for most museums like the Smithsonian, they have many orders of magnitude more people visiting them online than in person now, 10 or 100 times more unique visitors on their websites. And so for a lot of people, the kind of web version of the museum is the museum at this point. So I think there's a lot of soul searching, because for many generations, museums have been about that unique experience. Brent Glass, who's the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, over dinner, I was sort of talking to him about this, and he was saying that so many people come to his museum and have this kind of seminal experience, let's say with their kids, of showing them, Betsy Ross's flag or, some object. I mean, even if it's something more comical like Seinfeld's puffy shirt, but it's the experience of kind of seeing that in person with the family, that social experience. And his feeling was, or his worry was, doesn't the digital version kind of lose that social experience? Doesn't it kind of pull the object out of that experience, where the grandfather says to the granddaughter, here, this is the, this very, Thomas Jefferson's desk. That's his very, his actual desk. And he said that that was the kind of connection that needs to be made to the physical objects that kind of leads to a lifelong interest in, let's say, history. And that he worried about the kind of grazing that goes on online.
It's an interesting perspective. I think that what that might miss is that we have vast possibilities to provide remote visitors with more information and more context and more stuff surrounding the objects that they do want to see when they get to the museum, so that they're more prepared to interact with those objects and have a deeper experience with them. If you get to see Jefferson's desk, but also know something from the website about the African-American slave who actually built it, and the various versions of the document, the Declaration of Independence, that were drafted on it, and that it wasn't just Jefferson writing the document, and that he was making this migration between Virginia and Philadelphia. That if you have all of that information that can be wrapped around the object on the web, that you have an even deeper experience when you actually see the physical object in person.
Huh. Yeah, and I think I completely agree with Sharon on that. And I mean, I know I sound like Mills Kelly raving populist today, but I think one of the issues here is that museum professionals might be sort of lumping some group of them into this group that wants us to be reverent when we go to the museum. They're sort of forgetting the history of the museum. And Tom knows this way better than I do, but it's in the 19th century that we go from private collections to public museums. And it turns out the public, loves to see this stuff. And so, the exhibitions in Paris, the annual exhibitions in Paris just explode as, as events, as art events. And it's not because there are lots more middle-class people coming, which there were, but it's because not only are there lots more middle-class people coming, there are lots of workers who are showing up, and just the average people are showing up. And I think that's same kind of thing is happening in this new environment, which is, as these museums make more and more of their material available online, their audience is expanding, not linearly, but exponentially. And so they have to see, as Sharon is saying, that the more people see their material and the more they learn about the material, the more likely they are to come to the museum, as opposed to just graze the information and move on.
I think Mills makes a great point. I think that the technology has changed but I think the terms of the debate are the same. I think these are these debates over who gets to see the object, who gets to interpret the object, how many people, what kinds of people are allowed to engage an object. You know, these kinds of questions run throughout the long history of the museum, and these battles have been fought at various times. You know, Mills talks about the great exhibitions of the 19th century. And the museums that came out of those events, those battles were fought then. These same battles were fought in the museums that came out of the 17th and 18th century private collections, the Kunstkabinets. You know, I think these are questions that the museum has always had to deal with. And in many ways, I think that the museum is an exciting place because it's a place where we deal with these questions of, you know, who gets to decide which are the important objects and why they are important. It's a place where all kinds of people come together to have these arguments. And so, you know, this can be looked at in a long history of and as, you know, this is the purpose of the museum. The purpose of the museum is to provide a space in which we have these discussions. And I think something like Flickr Commons is a great place to do that. So, you know, all of these kind of either or questions, I think they're in some ways beside the point, and we're going to, you know, struggle through them, work through them, and come to a new consensus, which some new technology 10, 15, 20 years from now will disrupt again, and we'll have the conversation over again.
Well, we will continue to have this conversation on the podcast, and maybe in the future we'll get someone on from the Smithsonian to see how they're doing. We did notice just this morning, we're recording this on the 30th of January, Friday, and in today's Washington Post they had an article that the National Museum of the American Indian, another part of the Smithsonian network, is actually going to go ahead and digitize over the next 4 years their entire collection, because like all the other Smithsonian museums, they're only showing 1% of the collection on the actual floors of the museum. They've got 800,000 objects that are sitting in those cabinets behind the scenes. And so, you know, to use Chris Anderson's famous phrase, they'll get that long tail of the museum out there in a new digital way. Time, as always, each podcast we like to end with something we found online or piece of software that we like or a link or even a book or something in paper that we think our audience might appreciate. Mills, why don't we begin with you for your pick of the week?
Okay, mine's from the Office of Digital Humanities at the National Endowment for the Humanities, and that's they've announced their Digging Into Data Challenge, which is a brings together a lot of kind of big names in text mining and data analysis, the Joint Information Systems Committee from the UK, the NEH, the National Science Foundation, and the Social Sciences Humanities Research Council from Canada. And essentially, it's a text mining challenge or image mining challenge or just other kinds of data mining challenges that would be useful for people in the humanities. So if you're at all interested in the question of, you know, what are we going to do with a million books or a million images or 6 billion images when Flickr gets there, next week or whenever that happens. This is a something well worth looking at. I mean, it's not going to be a simple grant to apply for, but it's a program that I think has a lot of potential.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mills. Yeah, diggingintodata.org, I believe. You can find all the information about that. I think there's going to be some really interesting, creative, insightful, dynamic projects that are going to come out of that grand challenge. And we should say it's international. It's got partners in the UK and Canada, and NSF is going to participate as well here in the United States. So even beyond the humanities. Tom, what do you have for us this time?
I've got something from one of our projects, from the Omeka project. I wanted to let all our listeners know that we're going to be hosting a series of free workshops on how to use the Omeka software. We're calling them play dates. We've got two of them planned for Fairfax, for at CH&M in Fairfax, Virginia, one in February on February 20th, one in June on June 26th. We're going to have they're open to about 30 people. We're going to break people up into two different groups, one end users of the software, people who want to learn how to use the software to load collections and build exhibits, another workshop for developer designer types. And it's going to be very informal. We're just going to hang out and spend the day learning how to use Omeka. We're also going to be hosting one, or there's one being sponsored by the National Council for Public History at their annual meeting in April. So you can go to the omeka.org website under the documentation, look for workshops. You can find a list of them and sign-up sheets. It's first come, first serve, so just go onto the wiki and sign up and join us for some fun and some instruction on how to use Omeka.
Great. Thanks, Tom. I know there's a lot of interest about Omeka for exhibits at the Smithsonian this past weekend. Sharon, I hate to put you on the spot since you might not have known that we were going to do this pick of the week, but do you have something for us this week?
Well, actually, our conversation today suggested that I might remind folks that the nominations close for the Best of the Web 2009 Awards on the 31st, tomorrow. But what you'll be able to do if you go to conference.archiemuse.com is browse the sites that have been nominated, and there's the opportunity for you as users, for all of us, to make comments about those sites. And I think it's an important opportunity for all of us to push the museum community to think clearly about exposing metadata, about encouraging community building, about truly building in interactivity into the kinds of web projects that they're working on. And so it's a chance to see what the state of the field looks like today and to comment on that.
That's great. It's a nice way to run a contest, too, to have a kind of crowdsourced commentary rather than just a blue ribbon panel. So thanks for that recommendation, and we'll have a link to that from digitalcampus.tv. Well, my pick of the week is a Twitter tool, Mills, Twitter skeptic. Sorry to bring up another Twitter tool, but that I found really helpful. I thought actually Twitter really showed how it can be used well as part of the Smithsonian 2.0 meeting, where a lot of the conversation was happening via Twitter. A lot of the people who came were on Twitter, and we use what's called a hashtag, where we use the number or pound sign before a tag, and we used SI20. So if you do a search for that tag at search.twitter.com, you'll get all of our conversations. And then I could track that via software called TweetDeck, which is, as far as I can tell, the only way that if I'm going to keep Twittering, I can kind of manage that whole Twitter rapid-fire environment. And TweetDeck is an Adobe Air application, so you have to download the Adobe Air kind of base software. But it runs, once you do that, it'll run on Linux, Mac, or Windows. And TweetDeck just provides a nice sort of calm, dark environment with a set of columns that you can set up to track different things. You can track what all your friends are doing, but then you can set up a special column for, let's say in this case, just the stream of tweets about a particular topic like Smithsonian 2.0. And by doing that, I was really able to see what was going on, to respond to people in real time. If I was in a session, I could see what was going on in the other session and talk to some of the panelists there. I think it's a nice piece of software. You need to turn it off when you're doing writing because it's in real time and it just looks like literally a river of tweets. And so it's it can be pretty distracting if you have it up there on the screen. But it's the best tool I've found for managing Twitter. And so give it a try. Again, I want to remind our audience that Digital Campus is on Twitter now at Digital Campus and all one word. And of course, you can see us online at our beautiful new website, courtesy of Jeremy Boggs at digitalcampus.tv. We do hope that you'll join us there on Twitter, on the website, comment on this episode, number 37. And we're looking forward to another conversation on the Digital Campus podcast in 2 weeks. I want to thank Sharon Leon for joining us. And Sharon, we'll have you back on to talk about museums and other topics from the center and elsewhere in a future podcast. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Dan. I've enjoyed it.
Okay, and thanks, Mill and Tom. I'll talk to you all soon, and thanks again to our audience. We'll see you again in another 2 weeks for another episode of Digital Campus. please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you.